is the Next Trip Podcast with aviation insiders Doug and Drew. Together, with more than 40 years of industry experience, they are creating a network for other av geeks and travel enthusiasts to obsess about all things aviation. All thoughts and opinions are their own.
Good day and welcome to Boarding Pass 233, operating on May 13th, 2024. This is Drew, an airline ops manager and aspiring Cessna 172 pilot. I'm here with my buddy Doug, an airline pilot. We're here to discuss aviation topics from an industry insider's perspective. I look at you and I think mime, because you're wearing a collarless shirt with horizontal stripes. Kind of looks like Waldo a little bit. And you've got your baseball hat backwards, so it could be like, you know, one of those, like, I don't know, what's the hat they wear? Berets. Doug, passengers from New York City to Paris this week, they may have been confused when they heard you say, if you announced it, your SFO-based flight crew welcomes you on board. Did you announce that, and why were you flying from New York to Europe?
No, I did not announce that, and I'm guessing the flight attendants probably didn't. I know we talked about this a couple weeks ago. What do flight attendants say when the pilots are operating a different flight? I think we talked about it when I was doing one of our hubs to one of our other hubs, which is not the base that I'm at. Why was I doing Newark to Paris? That's a great question. Usually wide bodies, or not usually, because I've done some Houston to Europe. Most of my flights, yes, they originate in San Francisco. They go somewhere and then they come back. But it's a big network. We have lots of pilots who are qualified to fly these airplanes. I don't know what's going on at network planning. I don't understand why sometimes we have these, as I called it, a triangle route, where I operated to Newark and then operated to Paris and then came back to San Francisco. Somewhere in some room in headquarters are a bunch of brilliant people with a bunch of computers and algorithms, and they look at it. Yeah. It's only for like a month or two right now. They say, for this month, this is how we're going to operate this service.
It's probably because we have all these new flights to Europe from the East Coast that... Mm-hmm. Newark has a 777 base that just didn't have enough 777 pilots for that surge
It. Yeah, that's most likely it. It could be a training backlog. It could be that they plussed up some flights that they weren't expecting and they needed the crews to cover it. Drew, I know that we've talked about this multiple times in the past. We actually have a story about sports coming up. Sports and cultural events and aviation have direct connections, especially in this day and age of relatively cheap travel. I understand there are probably some people who just bought tickets who say, yeah, it's not relatively cheap. I'm one of those. I just bought our Thanksgiving tickets, and it cost me a pretty penny, but I figured the prices are only going to go up. Anyways, I digress. Drew, half of the flight, and this is not an exaggeration, half of the flight, we were full, totally full, not a single open seat. Half of the people on that flight were on their way to Paris for the Taylor Swift concert this weekend. She was playing Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. Half of my 777-200 from Newark to Paris was full of Swifties flying to Paris, jetting off to Europe to go to the Taylor Swift concert. We've talked about the economic impact, I think, probably a year ago when she was in Australia. We talked about how Qantas was scheduling flights that they wouldn't otherwise operate just for her. We've talked about the economic impact, the millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that something like this brings. I saw it firsthand. I got to experience
that. How did you know
firsthand.
That? Just from the t-shirts and the demographic?
The t-shirts and the flight attendants. Actually, we had a couple non-revs who were going for the concert as well. And they made a comment that they were talking to people in the gate area and they figured probably about half of them. So as they were deplaning, we're standing there saying thank you for flying with us. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start asking. I was like, you go into the Swift concert, and the next 10 people were like, yeah, that's why we're here. That's why we're going.
Okay, so whenever people start complaining about gas prices or, oh my God, everything's so expensive, it's like you have half a plane that's going to Europe, not for their family vacation, not for a yearly thing, not for some school partnership program. They're going for a concert. They are going for 2 to 3 days.
Well, I just mentioned cultural things. I feel like I hit that side, like the Swiftie side, twice, because I was in New York on Monday night. We were staying downtown. Monday night was the Met Gala, and if you don't know what that is like the who's who of fashion
politics,
like Hollywood and famous people, and you don't go unless you are someone, and arguably it is probably the hardest ticket in the world to to get for anything. Throw the Super Bowl aside, throw the Olympics aside. Getting into the Met Gala is probably the
hardest thing. $750,000 for a table of 10 or something ridiculous like that.
It was crazy, though, because walking around the city, I saw all these Met Gala parties, and they were not the who's who. They were maybe several rungs below, but there were all these parties, and just seeing that. And in fact, I walked past, I didn't realize this was going on. I stumbled past the New York Yankees Met Gala party, and I saw a bunch of their famous players walking in, all dressed to the nines. They're not going to the actual Met Gala, but their organization is throwing a party. And we were talking to our van driver. He said, oh, yeah, all these organizations who can't get in, they throw their own parties during the Met Gala. Okay. So here I am in New York during the Met Gala. I get to see all this. And then I'm flying all these Swifties to Paris.
Again, you know, we talked about this, that people are spending money on moments and experiences versus TVs and cars, I guess.
That's intangibles versus tangibles. Well, I guess travel could be considered tangible. And what did Ed Bastian say? The quote that we really liked, investing in yourself, investing in the experience. Mm. And we said investing is a great way to sum that up, that these people, like you said, instead of buying a new TV, they're buying the experience, and it's something that will last with them forever. The TV will break. They'll replace whatever Amazon boxes they got. But the memory of going to Paris for a Swift concert or going to one of these Met Gala parties, that'll stay with you forever.
Well, you know, and I'm just thinking about the younger people that I know, like Patrick and Ryan at work. They are spending money on experiences. Patrick's always jetting off to San Diego or someplace using his non-rev benefits. It's not necessarily cheap, because once you get there, you have food and hotels. And then Ryan has been going on trips with his girlfriend. He just got his private pilot's license. So yes, a lot of, you know, spending on experiences versus material things. So that's good. Now, we're talking about your trip. It was a triangle route. And I mentioned there was a French inference, because you were just in France and you look like you just got back from France. You look like a French tourist, actually. You have a fanny pack on also.
Yeah, the Crossways fanny pack.
Yeah. So it was a triangle route. That must have been very hard on your body clock, because now you're balancing three different time zones and three different sleep cycles.
It was. Luckily, we had almost 24 hours in New York and I got a really good night of sleep, which was actually great, because a lot of times when I leave for Europe, I'm taking care of family stuff at home, and then I go to the airport, I try a nap. I had nothing to do other than I wanted to get up and run and grab a slice of pizza in New York. I was able to sleep in, I got a great night of sleep. But then when I got to Paris, as I sometimes do, I hit the ground running. Drew, I got back to my hotel at like 4 o'clock local time in Paris, and I crashed. I mean, because I'd been awake since basically the night before in New York, I slept so hard that night. And then when I got back yesterday, I was just exhausted by the time I got home last night.
Yeah, it's like a whirlwind. You probably, you know, thinking back, you probably have to remember, were you in Paris? You know, like how many days ago were you in New York? It probably seems like weeks ago,
It's probably just so funny, because all the photos that I take, it automatically uploads to Google Photos. And I think the algorithms for Google Photos, they're definitely not made for people in our line of work, who travel all the time. They're more made for, I guess, normal people. I hate to call it that, where you do this once a year trip to Europe or something, and then your Google Photos reminds you, remember your trip to Paris, order these books and all this. Mm-hmm. I keep getting these like five times a month. It's like recent memories from your trip to Sydney. It's like, I've been there twice in the last month. I mean, I haven't, not to Sydney, but I'm in Frankfurt and I get reminded of my previous Frankfurt trip from Google Photos. It's like, remember the memories that you made in Frankfurt. I'm sitting here right now again.
Yeah, because it's such a big event for most people. All right, your mission was to get a t-shirt. Did you get your Paris Olympics t-shirt?
I did, yes. And I looked it up, and there was this one Olympic store in all of Paris, the official Olympic store. I walked almost 3 miles from the hotel. It was great. I made it a thing. I went by the Louvre. I went by Notre Dame. I was like, I'm not just going to walk to the Olympic store without actually doing some sightseeing along the way. And because it was the one and only official Olympic store, I was picturing this giant facility, tons of things. No, it was the size of a coat closet where I used to record from. And there were like five t-shirts total, different styles in there. I should have just waited until I got to the airport, because there was more selection and duty-free at the airport than at the official Paris Olympic store. But yes, I did get the t-shirt.
Okay, so other than the closet gift store, did you feel an Olympic buzz around the city?
There definitely was. There's construction everywhere. And I was there 2 months ago, and there was a little bit, but not quite like what I saw. I think I sent you a picture of these grandstands that are going in right across the river from the Eiffel Tower. It's a U-shaped bowl that you're going to be watching the sand volleyball with the Eiffel Tower right behind it. It is going to be a picturesque Olympics in a lot of these venues. There's a giant countdown clock like right under the Eiffel Tower, right on the Seine, with like days and hours until the opening ceremonies and the kickoff. There definitely is a buzz, and there are posters all over. It was really pretty cool to be there and start to see that.
Yeah, I've been invited to Paris to the Sri Lankan embassy because Ashok, who is on a partial episode with us, he's doing a book signing. But Doug, I don't know if I'm going. Number one, our flights are full, even though it'll be the end of May. And the hotels are exorbitantly expensive in Europe. And plus, they're dealing with a bed bug situation. I think that's mostly over now because people weren't going to Paris for a while because there was a bed bug infestation. But I think they've cleaned that up before the Olympics. That's great that the flights are full. All right, for me, I was going to talk about, there was nothing big going on in Washington, D.C. as far as weather events or anything. But there was flooding in Houston. Massive thunderstorms in Chicago. You'd think it'd be a beautiful day here, but it's not because you have two of our hubs that are in crisis, so we have a lot of delays. So it's quick turn city. We have this, if we're not going to be on time, we have to make our quick turn time. We call it the minimum service time. So we did a great job turning those planes. We have a goal of 40%. 40% of them should make it within the turn time. And that seems low, and that's because the company has a very ambitious turn time for all these flights. So that's a good thing. Other than that, nothing else. Other than this week, today my flight was canceled again, my flight training, because it's raining outside.
First it was TFRs, presidential TFRs, and then it was winter weather. And I feel like we just jumped, at least here, we jumped straight from winter last week, that rain-drenched 50-degree swim meet that I was at. It's 95 today. Where was spring? We didn't have spring.
The weather is up and down. It was 90 degrees here a couple days ago, and today it's in the 50s and rainy. We were talking about Paris. Doug, you were just there. Paris will host the 2024 Olympic Games in a few months. You talked about the Olympic buzz and how that's already being felt around the city as it plans to welcome the world. Paris airports will be the first and last experiences visitors to the Olympics will have. So let's see how they're preparing.
I was just at Paris Charles de Gaulle. They're going to handle most of the international traffic, but Paris Orly and Paris Le Bourget will also be operating at full capacity from the period around July 26th to August 11th, which is when the games will be running. Aéroports de Paris, or ADP, how was my French? Was that pretty good?
Aéroports de Paris. And
Aéroport
you said,
de Paris.
And it's Le Bourget.
Le Bourget. Which manages the three airports, expects 60,000 accredited Olympic guests, including athletes and coaches, plus 20,000 government and media representatives during the period. The total number of travelers through the airports is not much different from a busy summer week. However, the amount of oversized checked items will far exceed normal levels. The airports are upgrading baggage handling systems, and they're creating hold areas to manage the volume.
Is that interesting? I thought the traffic would be more, but they're saying, no, it's just going to be heavy summer volumes. And I think it's kind of evening it out because a lot of people will avoid Paris because things are so expensive and packed that they'll go someplace else for their vacation if they're not going to the Olympics.
This is not the first Olympic Games either. These happen every 2 years, the Winter Olympics and Summer Olympics. Mm. All of these cities have the giant committees. The Olympics are picked 7, 8, 9 years in advance, and it takes that long to actually plan for it. And they're not operating in a vacuum. I guarantee that Paris officials have been talking to Tokyo officials and Rio officials and London officials and Beijing going all the way back. How did you handle this? Well, Beijing, they built a brand new airport, but that's beside the point. All these other cities, how did you handle the increase in baggage volume? How did you increase manage the increase in tourists coming in? All of that. It's not the first time that this has been held. Yes, it's the first time in our era that Paris has hosted these, but they still have these other cities that have previously done this that they can lean on and try and get an idea of, okay, what went wrong? What went well? How do we do it better?
You can say that, but as someone who has to plan for events that are going to happen. There's always the, you know, the butterflies in your stomach and what is going to happen. So I don't think anyone's relaxing, even though they probably have like a to-do list from Tokyo or from Seoul or wherever, you know, the last Olympics were. ABC reports that another challenge for aviation specifically is a planned no-fly zone over the Paris region for 6 hours during the July 26th opening ceremonies. This serves as a security precaution with at least one French military AWACS surveillance aircraft patrolling the skies. Other military aircraft can also scramble to intercept any non-authorized flights that enter Olympic airspace. I thought they were talking about some kind of aviation display of French military might, but everything says that it's just a security.
Hopefully there will be no display. Hopefully there will be no display of French aviation might.
Oh, you think that would be too one-sided
for No, I'm saying if there is, that would mean that they're responding to something.
Well, yeah, I'm talking about in a more pageant type of way, not an actual military action. ADP said that airlines would have to fly around the restricted airspace, which extends 93 miles outside of central Paris. I couldn't find any information whether the airports would be closed. It doesn't seem like it.
My guess is it'll be just like Reagan National in D.C., where there will be probably special approaches or special corridors. And those airplanes will be allowed in those corridors. If anyone strays, then that could be an issue. It's only for 6 hours and it's in the evening. Usually most of the arrivals, at least from North America, come in the morning and early afternoon. And then most of the departures have already gone out by then. So the flow of traffic, and maybe for that one day, they adjust the flight schedules so that it's very minimal and there aren't that many. But my guess is they'll have special accommodations, special corridors. Depending on which direction you land at De Gaulle, you do go somewhat close to downtown, but it's still like 10, 15 miles away. They just probably will vector the flights on longer vectors so that no one actually flies right over downtown, which it's the opening ceremonies, I guess, are not going to be held in a stadium like they usually are. They're actually being held along the Seine. It's going to be this pageantry, this parade right downtown along the Seine. That's going to be pretty cool to see.
Right. They're expecting like 300,000 people to be watching it. ADP also said that there is still a very, very high probability that small electric-powered airborne taxis will be trialed with passengers over Paris during the July 26th through August 11th games, which he said would be a world first. We've been waiting for these electric air taxis. Could this be the debut, and could one of these American companies also participate? Like we had Oscar, the CEO of United, he's on the board of Archer that is making these aircraft, and I believe some of them are ready to fly. This would be a great opportunity. Can I just bellyache a little bit? Here we are in 2024, and we're hoping that we'd see a tiny little Mutant Ninja Turtle blender engine Archer plane flying over the Seine, when in the 70s they could have flown a Concorde over the Seine, you know, an aircraft that flies supersonic. So come on, aviation people, let's get something more exciting than an air taxi. I digress.
This actually bodes well for our first news story, so let's move into that, Drew. Mm. Electric air taxis are expected to be flying paying passengers this year or next, but what about electric airliners? Although we won't see those anytime soon, we're seeing another startup that's showing some promise. Elysian Aircraft of Holland is working on a 90-seat electric-powered airliner called the E9X. What have we talked about, Drew? We said all these startups, we're just going to continue seeing them.
So many.
Yeah, maybe not all of them. Maybe not all of them will actually come to fruition, but the sheer number of startups that we're seeing leads me to believe that at least some of them will see the light of day and will be very successful.
Yeah, I think that we're so, and again, we love Airbus and Boeing, but we just want to see something new. And so we are promoting them, and so are their governments. I mean, we're going to read the story, but there seems to be a lot of support from the existing aviation establishment.
We've seen investment from multiple airlines in a lot of these different ventures and startups. Here are the bullets on this E9X, though. The company is targeting its first flight by 2033 for the E9X, which will carry 90 passengers up to 500 miles or 800 kilometers. It's a pretty cool looking airplane. Look it up right now.
It really is.
8 1.5 megawatt electric motors will power the E9X. It's got a very big wingspan. It's got four motors per engine. It looks kind of weird and freaky. We've talked about that too, that we can't get pigeonholed into the current concept of an airplane. the right. airliners of the future are going to look like the future. They're not going to look like the present or the past.
Well, it definitely looks different. And we'll put a picture of it on the website with the show notes. But Doug, it's almost, you know, it's almost like Back to the Future. It reminds me of the Constellation.
It does, doesn't it?
Right? It had six engines. This one has eight.
The Connie only had four engines, two per wing, but it does. It does look like that.
Okay.
The startup has some big names in Dutch aviation leading it. CEO Daniel Rosen Jacobsen previously worked at Google. Co-CEO Rob Wolleswinkel was previously at Fokker. Chief Technology Officer Reinhard de Vrie, who has been involved with EU and Delft University's sustainable aviation projects. Just this week, another eight people joined the company, all from Dutch aviation, including a representative from KLM Eindhoven Airport. Everyone's jumping on board with this thing, Drew. Elysian says KLM will provide, quote, valuable insight regarding airline operations and what is needed for the airline fleets in the future, unquote. While airport input will allow the company to understand ground operations and infrastructure requirements. This is great. This is airlines who are going to be ordering this thing, helping design this thing.
There's someone from the airport community who will tell them what will work and what won't at existing airports. We haven't talked about this before. This is the E9X, 500 miles. They're actually saying that 50% of commercial aviation, our trips are of this range. I have to verify, but that is a lot. That is a huge, that is a significant portion of commercial aviation, if it's true what they're saying. The electric technology and battery storage, all that is improving by leaps and bounds. So do you remember the Nissan Leaf when it came out?
Yeah.
It was one of the first completely electric cars. It had a range of 70 miles, right? I mean, talk about range anxiety, right?
I have range anxiety with 300 miles. I can't imagine 70.
Robbie gets 247 miles in his new car. He has total range anxiety, right? Even though his commute is only 30 miles round trip, you could go to work for 2 weeks. You have range anxiety with 300-mile range, but I'm hearing about cars that will have 1,000 miles range in the near future. Car battery technology is not much different than the battery that will power these motors. So I think they're going to kind of merge in terms of technology so that one actually helps the other. We're not anywhere close to electric, like a huge Ninja Blender engine slung under a 777-300. It just can't go that fast. And I think the cowling provides a lot of aerodynamic features so that it can go faster. So I don't know when we will see it on a transcontinental or an airliner that crosses an ocean, but this is a start. All right, Doug, we have a few episodes to go before we talk about the inaugural flight of the first electric airliner, but we only have to wait until the fall, hopefully, to talk about a new version of the A321, the XLR, or the extra long range. Do you pronounce it Iberia, or Iberia?
I say Iberia, but I think the Spanish pronunciation is Iberia.
Iberia of Spain will be the launch customer of the A321 XLR and not Aer Lingus because the Irish carrier is currently involved in some pilot salary negotiations. The pilots want a 20% increase. Aer Lingus is offering 8%, so they're not even close. So that'll take a while to resolve. IAG, which owns both carriers, they had ordered 14 XLRs. It seems like a very small amount, so they're just kind of dipping their feet in the water. But there were 8 planned for Iberia and 6 to Aer Lingus. Iberia wasted no time taking delivery front runner status by announcing its first routes, which are Madrid to Boston and Washington Dulles. So the airport where I work could be the inaugural destination of the first A321 XLR. If all goes well with the A321 XLR certification, we should see the aircraft in the fall or winter of this year.
Can certification I jump in real has quick?
Been. Yep.
Okay, let me just say something. Madrid to Dulles on an A321 XLR. That's a yawn to me. Do you know why?
Oh, there are
because TAP already is flying Neos 321, the regular Neos. From Lisbon to your station. Madrid is not that much farther past Lisbon. The XLR could do so much. The XLR could do Madrid to Chicago or Madrid to Denver. So the fact that they're launching these routes on routes that the Neo probably could already fly today is kind of like, come on, do something more splashy.
Well, right. As you said, SAS flies the A321 to Dulles. Aer Lingus flies the A321. You mentioned TAP, so it's not going to be a stretch to fly from Madrid, which is actually probably closer than Copenhagen. Yeah, I wonder why they didn't choose Chicago. But maybe they're concerned, because and we're going to talk about the range issues in a second.
They need to figure it out first, figure out what it's capable of. And they don't want to launch something that then they're going to have to drop into Halifax or Gander for a tech stop because they don't have the range to make it the entire way.
Right. So this 4,700 nautical mile range is what's been promoted. So we'll talk about that in a second. But here's the problem. Certification has been delayed because they had to redesign the additional fuel tank, which is housed in the fuselage of the aircraft and not the wings. So it's located just aft of the wings in the fuselage. So it's going to take up some of the baggage and cargo area for the rear cargo pit. They're doing modifications to add fire safety protective lining to the tank. This may add about 1,500 to 1,700 pounds of weight, which may cause a 200 nautical mile reduction in range. And just this week, the FAA, it may have been yesterday or very recently, the FAA is concerned about the safety protective lining, which protects the cabin. But now they're raising concerns about if there's a crash with the fuel tank on the fuselage, is there enough insulation to allow at least 5 minutes for the customers to evacuate
before the fire?
Yep.
As a reminder, the A321 XLR is a narrow-body airliner which seats 180 to 220 passengers, a range of 4,700 nautical miles, as you said, which could be reduced to 4,500 now, or somewhere around 11 hours. Airbus claims it'll be 30% more efficient than previous generation aircraft. Take that, 757, 30%. We keep saying 20%, 20%, right. 20%. This is nice that we're actually up to now possibly 30%. We'll see if that's what it ends up being when it actually flies. The range opens London to Vancouver and Delhi and Sydney to Kuala Lumpur, all in narrow body flying. 11 hours on a narrow body. Drew, how does that sound?
It sounds miserable. Just to do 6 hours, almost 6 hours to the West Coast in a narrow body, it makes me want to stop someplace like in Denver or Houston just to stretch my legs. If I was in a premium cabin with a lie flat seat, yeah, no problem.
When I took the family to Santiago on our airline a month ago, we were on a 767. The 76 is great because it's 232. It's not 343 like on the triple.
Yeah.
But it just felt a lot tighter, even in the back galley where how the labs are set up and everything. And even the flight attendants, I was in the back alley talking with them, they said, oh, we much prefer to fly on the triple, because I said, yeah, I'm on the triple. They said, oh, the triple is just so much easier, there's so much more room for people to move around. We don't like these 10-hour flights on the 7-6 because it's just so cramped. And that's a wide body, and that is a very comfortable wide body with the 232, the double aisle, only one middle seat, all of that. But yet they're still saying we prefer the triple, which is 343. And I've seen that. The aisles and the galleys get really crowded on the 767. And especially, we've all been on A320s, 21s, 737s, when you only have one aisle and everyone's trying to get to the lav in the back and it gets backed up down the aisle when you don't have a second aisle to move around. Imagine being on that for 10 or 11 hours. This isn't great for the passenger. This is great for the airlines to be able to launch these new routes. It is good for the passengers in that, I don't know, pick a city, Indianapolis or something. Indianapolis might get nonstop service to Berlin, which never would have happened if this airplane hadn't come out. That's where the possibilities are. I just hope that the airlines, and I think I've said this before, I hope that it was meant to open up these routes, just like the 787 was, but airlines instead are using it more hub to major city, the 787, that is. Will this, it's supposed to open up Indy to Berlin, or that's just one example. I could see it going more, instead of hourly service between London and New York, now you have half hourly service. It's not really going to open up these new routes. It's just going to be more frequencies on the routes that already exist.
Well, yeah, so we're talking about the bad parts of it, but just from my station, you know, it could open up routes to Nice. It could open up routes to Seville, Spain, open up routes to maybe some places in South America. Would you rather have that in a narrow body or not have it at all? The other thing that's good, Doug, is it's taking people nonstop to these cities. That's going to cause more of a need for the 787, which is a smaller wide body, to go between the larger cities. So it's like, you really don't need, I mean, do we need a 777-9X size plane? Yes, probably for some routes. But I think with all of these routes going everywhere to smaller cities, people won't have to transition through a hub. I don't know. So it's better than not having anything. But yeah, I mean, if we're non-revving and the only seat is a middle seat on an A321 XLR from Paris to San Francisco, just suck it up. you're going to get home, you know, where that flight may not have existed before, right?
Paris to San Francisco yesterday was just over 5,000 nautical miles. The 321 XLR won't be able to do that, luckily.
I wonder if it could go to London. It might just make it to... We'll have to see. Because they're saying at 4,700 nautical miles, the range is as much as the first 747s, the 100s.
I think London to San Francisco probably is not possible. Maybe the opposite direction, San Fran to London with the tailwind. But I think London to San Fran is still a little bit too far.
Well, okay, so they're talking about London to Vancouver. I guess that would be an hour closer than SFO. As you come in from the north, but still, wait, no, 11 hours? Yeah, you could probably make it to SFO. We'll have to look at this.
No, it's probably gonna be right they on that said cusp. Or 11 hours. That's probably if you're flying slow. But if it's 4,700 nautical miles, then London to San Francisco is not possible.
Okay, then you're safe. So it's probably going to be a wide body for you to SFO from Europe nonstop. So yes. You should be happy about that. All right. Well, regardless of our depression with A330. All of these carriers that we just mentioned, SAS, Iberia, Aer Lingus, TAP Portugal, they're replacing a lot of A330 routes with downgraded narrow bodies. We're depressed about that, but we will be excited to see some of the first landings in Washington, D.C. So Ryan and Patrick, I'm sure all of us will be out there with our cameras when this A321 XLR lands, and we'll act like we're bored, but we'll be really excited the day it comes in. So yeah, we'll be there for the Iberia sheet cake. Either way, they'll both be using ADS-B to communicate their location. I hear this a lot, Doug, and those of us in the aviation community probably hear this, ADS-B. I want to know for myself, what exactly does that mean? So I thought we'd do a segment on it. And I see that a lot in my private pilot training, because we're required to have ADS-B in these planes in certain airspaces. Last week, we talked about aircraft visibility, Doug, or lack thereof, over vast stretches of ocean with no radar or ATC coverage, namely over the Pacific or the Atlantic. The aircraft do, however, have ADS-B, which, although archaic, works to... And when I say archaic, it's only about 20 years old. ADS-B is still reasonably new. They work to transmit their location to ground stations and other aircraft that have ADS-B. Doug, we hear about this a lot, but what is it?
Drew, here's where the FAA actually does help. I know we joke about it. We say, I'm from the FAA, I'm here to help. And we're like, no, you're not. But I digress. This is actually how they are helping. This is a definition from the FAA. ADS-B, or Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast, is a surveillance technology that combines an aircraft's positioning source, aircraft avionics, and ground infrastructure to create an accurate surveillance interface between aircraft and ATC. Here are the pieces of it. Automatic. The transmissions are made without interrogation from ground radar. They're just constantly sending this information. Dependent. It requires a position source on board the aircraft, which most airplanes, it's GPS. Surveillance. It provides radar-like surveillance and then broadcast. Continually transmits the position data.
Let me just ask a question. So this ADS-B on your 777 is transmitting. That's only to other aircraft in the vicinity and to ground stations that might be able to receive the transmission, right?
Correct. And here's how you know where you're actually transmitting. Pick a route. Go on Flight Radar 24 or FlightAware right now. Pick a route from one city to another. Call it London to San Francisco. When you look at for a flight that's already completed the flight, when you look at the map, like on FlightAware, there are different colors along that flight's path. One is, I think, white, one is blue. Basically, you'll be able to know where the ADS-B data was transmitting to a ground station, and then you'll be able to see where it went into either non-radar environment or non-ADS-B coverage, and that's where position reports are being made. That's where we're using CPDLC. And then there might be like small swaths of a flight For instance, a flight from the West Coast to Asia goes up over the Aleutian Islands. When we're off the coast of Vancouver initially, we lose that ADS-B coverage. Then once we get closer to Alaska and fly over the Aleutians for a stretch, it shows up again and we have that ADS-B. And then once we leave the Aleutians and we're headed back downhill toward Japan off the coast of Russia, but too far away that there are no ADS-B stations, it goes back to not showing on ADS-B coverage. We don't know on the airplane when we're in ADS-B coverage or not. That's completely transparent to us. All we know is we have ADS-B, we are broadcasting. Sometimes it's being picked up, sometimes it's not.
And you know, these ADS-B units are cheap. I don't know exactly how much they are, but we'll talk about Flight Radar 24. They were giving them away. I think they were saying if you could house, if you could mount a unit, you know, they were asking if you could do that so that they would have more. ADS-B, it's more precise than radar and consists of two different services, ADS-B out and ADS-B in. The FAA requires ADS-B out capability in the continental United States in Class A, B, and C airspace and Class E airspace at or above 10,000 feet and within 30 nautical miles of a Class B primary airport. So if you're someplace just mildly populated, even with a small airport, you're required to have this equipment on your Cessna 172 or your Cherokee Warrior. Now, the AvGeeks will be familiar with these. Flight Radar 24, FlightAware, and other aircraft tracking apps have networks of thousands of these ADS-B ground-based receivers around the world that receive flight information from aircraft with ADS-B transponders, and then they send this information to their servers so that we can see it on the Flight Radar 24 app.
That's why 10 years ago, when FlightAware first came out, and you saw a Cessna 172 fly over, and it didn't show up, and you couldn't get any information on it. And now, Drew flies over your house today, or well, you're not flying today. Oh. If you fly tomorrow, if you fly over one of our listeners' houses tomorrow, they'll be able to see it. That's because it's now required on the airplanes to be able to have that ADS-B. That's why we're able to actually track all those small airplanes now, let alone all the big commercial airplanes.
Yeah, I was shocked that I could plug in the N number for my Cessna that I'm flying, or the two or three that I fly, and they're in there. Mm-hmm. And I think I sent you one of my first flights, you know, showing the pattern. So how cool is that to have that visibility? And when I pull up, we use, there's several apps that you can use, but we use something called 4Flight. I don't know, does the company use that
for flight planning? We don't use 4Flight, we use Jepsen, but I use 4Flight in the Air Force.
Okay, so 4Flight, you can, there's a menu option to pick traffic, and you can see all the planes in the sky. And that's me, that's with a five-year-old iPad that's connected, that's tethered to the hotspot on my mobile phone. I can see what's going on. It's great. It's great for safety because we have this equipment in the airplane, but then you can also have it on your iPad. There's a lot of visibility and a lot less chance of any in-flight, any mid-air collision.
I use Flight Radar 24 every single time I go to work. The situational awareness is huge for us because it shows ground taxiing. I can see and I look at what taxi routes the airplanes are taking, especially in places like Paris, where it might have been a couple months since I've been there. They're using a runway that I haven't used before, trying to figure out how we are going to get from where we're at to the runway. Understanding ATC tells us, but to go in with kind of an idea of this is how we're probably going to get there is huge. And I'll use it when we're in the van, like yesterday morning, in the van from the hotel back to the airport. I was on Flight Radar 24 looking and seeing what runways they were using for landing, what runways they were using for departure, whether it was west flow or east flow. Because when I get to the airplane, yes, I can get the ATIS and the information is in there. But it's better to go in knowing, okay, which departure are we going to be on? Which runway are we going to be using? And I can pull up Flight Radar 24 or FlightAware, and I can get that information immediately.
Instantly.
I use it professionally. It is a great tool to be able to use to get additional situational awareness beyond just what we have on our iPad, beyond just what we get from air traffic control when we get to the airplane.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, instead of having to get your iPad out, log into your company, you know, your company intranet, you can just get this from your cell phone, from the Flight Radar 24 app, or FlightAware is another one that we use. Sometimes I'll just put that up. If we have an aircraft situation, I'll just go to FlightAware, and I'll put that on the big screen, because it's just so quick. to get to. Doug, we did it, a whole or almost a whole episode without any Boeing drama. But wait, there is some aviation drama going on in your neck of the woods. Have you heard about this?
I've heard about this.
And I'm like, do we really want, it just seems so frivolous that I didn't really want to talk about it, but it is, it's real. I mean, we're talking lawyers and lawsuits and
it's a very big deal. It shouldn't be, but it's a big deal.
Question is, would the real Slim Shady or the real San Francisco Bay Area Airport stand up?
they can both stand up, Drew, as they both are on the San Francisco Bay. We're talking about Oakland Airport officially changing their name. The news channel KTVU in Oakland reported, the ink wasn't dry Thursday on the ordinance approved by the Oakland Board of Port Commissioners to change the name of Metropolitan Oakland International Airport to San Francisco Bay Oakland International Airport before Oakland took a shot at San Francisco. San Francisco sued Oakland on October 18th, asserting that the new name infringed on trademarks that San Francisco held on the name San Francisco International Airport. Oakland punched back with its attorney Mary Richardson saying, quote, the San Francisco city attorney decision to pursue litigation is an attempt to stop consumer education, prevent expanded air travel options for Bay Area residents and visitors, and is a misguided use of San Francisco taxpayer dollars, unquote.
Oh my God. So, I mean, she's saying they're affecting the children, right? Because you're affecting education about the geography of the Bay Area. We haven't discussed this. So, Doug, I don't know if you're Team OAK, Team Oakland, or Team SFO, but this is Oakland's defense. Oakland's counterclaim provides a history of its airport and discusses at length its geographic position on the San Francisco Bay. It says that the name change is intended to provide the accurate geographic location for the airport, not usurp San Francisco's trademark. So Oakland denies that any confusion will occur and says that in the world of airports, it's not unusual for more than one airport to use the same geographic name. The counterclaim offered several examples. London, England has 6 airports with London in their names. Paris, France, and Beijing, China each have 2. Domestically, Dallas has 2 airports with names beginning with Dallas, Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport and Dallas Love Field. Chicago has 3 airports with names that begin with Chicago. We got Chicago Midway, Chicago O'Hare, and Chicago Rockford. And then they didn't even mention Houston. Houston has 2 airports.
Well, and Chicago-Rockford really shouldn't even be Chicago. Just like Melbourne in Florida shouldn't be Orlando-Melbourne. We've talked about these in the past.
Yeah. Do you ever watch Come Fly With Me? It's this British comedy. It is so funny. And there's this skit where they're landing. They're supposed to be going to Barcelona, but they're landing in Shannon. And she's like, oh, we're about to touch down in Barcelona. And the passenger's like, wait a minute. We should still have like 3 hours to go to get to Barcelona. And the flight attendant goes, no, we're landing in Shannon, Barcelona. You'll be greeted by a shuttle, which will take you to some ferry to another. But they're making fun of these airports that are nowhere close, yeah. Right? We're landing in Shannon, Barcelona. San Francisco City Attorney David Chu said Thursday that San Francisco will be filing a motion for a preliminary injunction. No such motion has yet to be filed. So this has just happened where they have officially changed it. It looks like they've changed their whole media, their logo. Wikipedia even shows this new name. So it's so fast.
It's on Wikipedia. It's official.
A little story where I started laughing, but it wasn't a joke. So this was my last revenue 747 flight from London Heathrow to SFO. As we're landing, I was actually on this with Andy, who was on the show. We're looking outside a million-dollar view of downtown San Francisco as we're coming over the bay to land at SFO. And the flight attendant says, ladies and gentlemen, there's a beautiful view of San Francisco out the window and also a beautiful view of the other city by the bay, Oakland. I immediately started laughing because I'm from the Bay Area and Oakland is nothing that you would, equate with beauty or, you know, drama or anything. But she wasn't trying to be funny. Industrial. She's probably, and I am from the East Bay. I grew up just east of Oakland. So I shouldn't laugh. It is a beautiful area. Doug, I'm Team Oakland. Why can't they be the San Francisco Bay Area Oakland Airport? I'm fine with that.
Being San Francisco based, I probably shouldn't be, but I don't see what the big stink about this is. There are plenty of other examples of cities, and this isn't even a stretch. Oakland, as the crow flies, is just as close to downtown San Francisco as San Francisco International is. And, oh, by the way, San Francisco is saying that this is going to lead to massive consumer confusion. I don't know about you. I know we're probably a little bit different, but I think most people, when they book a flight and then they book the car, the next thing they do is they go to Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever you use, and they go, okay, how far is it from where I'm flying to the hotel I'm going to or the family? What's my route?
Oh, they don't care. Yeah.
I don't think that this is going to lead to any confusion. If anything, hopefully this increases service into Oakland, because people will be like, oh, wait, there's an alternate way for me to get to San Francisco or to the Bay Area. I don't just have to fly into Oakland. Or, I mean, well, I don't just have to fly into SFO.
Oakland, who's a Mary Richardson or whatever their attorney, you can use this. San Francisco Airport is also nowhere near San Francisco itself. It's 14 miles south of San Francisco proper. So I actually looked at this on Google Maps. The travel distance between San Francisco downtown and SFO is only 7 minutes less than from SFO to Oakland Airport.
Yes.
And if you're taking BART, which is the Metro Rail.
I was going
to
say that.
It's the same. It's exactly the same.
If you accidentally end up in Oakland thinking that you're going to SFO and you're trying to get downtown in San Francisco, guess what? You take the you take the air train to BART, and then you take BART downtown, and you're going to be there in pretty close to the same time.
So don't
worry.
It's not
like we're talking about Sacramento naming 90 miles away, renaming it San Francisco Sacramento International Airport. No, this is Oakland. Drew, I literally cross the Bay Bridge to get to work, and I see Oakland traffic flying over my head, taking off over the Bay Bridge. On the Bay Bridge, I am closer to the Oakland airport than I am to the San Francisco airport.
Well, yeah, and it's the San Francisco Bay Area, right? So why shouldn't Oakland have a prominent, why shouldn't they be included in that?
Some of the arguments that I've heard is Oakland has become really crime-riddled recently, and people are saying you should put more resources into solving the crime and all of this, and the A's are moving out of town, the Raiders have already moved out, the Warriors moved out, there's a lot of businesses that are moving out.
Right, guess give them a hand.
Start here. Start with the airport, get more infusion of people coming in. That will increase your tax base. That will help, hopefully, get the city back up on its feet, because everyone who's been to Oakland or is from Oakland knows it's kind of a rough place right now, and it really does need some help. And if this is one way to help that, I'm all for it.
Right. Well, and San Francisco should promote that, right? Because if Oakland improves, you know, a rising tide helps all ships in the Bay Area. Public enemy number one, who we love, Aaron, who is here this week. I sent him this to say that we're going to talk about it. And, of course, that led to a debate, which lasted a long time, because Aaron doesn't just think, you know, one side of the issue. There's like 2 million sides. And as you talk to him, there's more branches that appear. So this was like a half an hour long conversation over WhatsApp. San Francisco Airport is not at San Francisco, but it's not part of San Mateo County. This was my argument. He was saying it's in San Mateo County.
Yeah, it's not even in San Francisco County. It's in a completely separate county.
It reports it's under the jurisdiction of the city of San Francisco, and I did not know this, but we were both right in the end. So did you know that the San Francisco Police Department has jurisdiction over San Francisco Airport? It's just another segment of fire department is the San Francisco Fire Department.
Yeah.
It has a San Francisco address. So when you're at SFO,
are you in San Mateo?
Yes, but that was the point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
So the example I used is if you're in Hawaii, you're not in a Polynesian country, you are in the United States, even though it's not within the contiguous 48, right? So that's how you have to look at SFO. But we did find something that said, I think it was, the San Francisco Airport website said that it is located in an unincorporated section of San Mateo County.
It's like Washington D.C. is contained within Maryland, but it's not part of Maryland. There's a part of Omaha, the Omaha metro area, on the west side of the Missouri River that's Iowa.
Yeah.
It's this little enclave right by the airport that is not physically in Iowa, but it is part of Iowa, and it resides completely within the borders of Nebraska. There is a part of Minnesota, Drew, I don't know if you knew this, there is a part of Minnesota that the only way to get there over land is to go through Canada, It's this little peninsula on a lake that the only way to get
you need your passport?
Yes, to drive through Canada to get to Minnesota.
That's crazy. You are in San Francisco, but you're not... You're within San Mateo County. We could go back and forth. I mean, this was like painful going back and forth. But I think we agreed that it is part of San Francisco, but it is located within San Mateo County. I'm getting a headache just thinking about this again. All right. But I also looked. Oakland Airport. He was right about this. Oakland Airport. I used Oakland Airport as an example because that's south of Oakland. No, it's actually connected to Oakland. So there is some gerrymandering around Alameda where it is truly a part of Oakland. You've got me there, Aaron. I think we were both right. I mean, we have San Francisco competing to get new routes, not Millbrae. Millbrae's not talking to the Philippines to get a nonstop route to Manila. Right. I don't know. Maybe they are. Doug, before we go, we have to mention that Mother's Day is this Sunday. So it was yesterday for our listeners. It's this weekend for us. So hopefully you have some flowers or something ordered, or you got to be sure to call your mom. We both love our mothers who have put up with and maybe even enabled our av-geekitude or av-geekness. I can't remember what word we coined, av-geekitude. Let's give our listeners one mom aviation story. You go first.
Well, my mother-in-law is here right now. She'll be here for Mother's Day. We'll celebrate with her. And then my parents will be here next weekend. I know it's the weekend after, so I'll be able to celebrate a week later with my mom. In person, we get to celebrate with both of them. Of course, I've got something from Marissa. I won't say what it is. Just, well, I guess it'll be after Mother's Day, but I got her a Lululemon gift card because that's
what she's been leaning toward.
And then the kids got her a necklace. It's one of those like three necklaces where they each can wear one, and it says mom, and then I think sister and sister, something like that, or daughter.
Oh.
So we've got that all set up. The one aviation story I'll say, growing up, traveling all the time, both of my parents were incredibly supportive of my love for aviation to the point where I wanted to get to the airport as early as possible. Most parents probably would be like, no, we're going to get there when we need to. I wanted to get there like 5 hours early so I could watch the planes. Right. My parents put up with that and encouraged it and allowed that to happen, which then fueled my continued love of aviation and got me to where I am today. I don't think that I possibly would be where I am today without that encouragement and that support and the, sure, we'll drag you to the airport so that you can go look at the airplanes many, many hours early. The one aviation story, though, that I think, and we talked about investing in the experiences, the one thing I think that will stand out for the rest of my life as one of my favorite aviation experiences ever with my mom was being able to fly her to Osaka on one of my trips.
Wow,
I was operating the airplane. She got to go to the country that she was born in and grew up in while I was working the flight. That, from a Mother's Day standpoint, will always stick with me.
Yeah, we had a whole episode with her on the show to talk about that. That was awesome. Like you know, our parents tolerated, my mom tolerated it more than my dad. Like, we lived in the Bay Area, so we're traveling from San Jose to San Francisco and back, and I would always throw a tantrum if we couldn't stop by the runway one right at SFO so we could watch planes. And my dad liked it. He would entertain it, but I want to do that every single time. And he would be like, no, we're not stopping at SFO so you can gawk at planes for an hour. You know, because we had to get home, but my mom would be the one, no, let's just stop for a few minutes.
She would
and I really appreciated that. Yeah, so I'd get, 10 to 15 minutes before my dad was like, okay, we're leaving. That's not to say he didn't support it, but he was more practical about it. But the one story I remember, this is how moms are different from your other relatives. We were on a 767 going to from Washington to Buenos Aires, and we just barely got on that flight. And there were three first-class seats and two economy. We had Robbie's mom, who's an amputee, so that was, of course, she's going to get a first-class seat. And my two parents got first-class seats. Robbie and I sat in the back. Robbie was moaning and groaning. I've told the story,
told
and I'm like,
that.
Get over it. We're not going to have your mom, who's an amputee, hobbling back to row 43 or whatever. He's like, I know. So they come down just before we close the door. I guess there was a no-show in business. And there was no discussion. There was no debate. Robbie was gone like flash, right? So he was there one moment. He was gone the next. I'm like, okay, I guess the higher the priority on this flight, the further back you are. I wanted them to have a good time. It was fine. So I'm sitting there, and this is like right after dinner. And my mom comes back with a little champagne from first class and her dessert. And she's like, oh, I just wanted to see how you're doing and if you want to change seats with me. Only a mother would do that. So I really appreciate that. I've had a bunch of experiences like you did with your mom traveling. I mean, just recently to Hong Kong. And I really appreciate that I'm able to do that for her. To both of our moms, happy Mother's Day. Thank you for putting up with us. And thank you for encouraging us, right, to do what we love. My parents, my mom, never wanted me to be a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer like some parents do. They just wanted to do what I loved. And they knew there was no choice anyway.
Right. Yeah, you're not going to go where they push you. You're going to go where you want to go.
To our friends and contributors, this podcast is your show, so go on our website, Next Trip Network, and let us know what's on your mind so we can talk about it or give us your feedback. You can also follow us on Instagram at Next Trip Podcast or on Threads. Please tell your friends about us so we can reach more people who love aviation and travel.
You can also call our hotline to ask a question or just rant about something. The number is 872-529-5620 when calling from the U.S., make sure to use country code 001 or +1 when calling from abroad. Thanks to all of our friends and contributors for your support and for joining the conversation. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, stay aviation tough.
This has been the Next Trip Podcast. Visit nexttripnetwork.com for information about previous episodes, trip reviews, aviation photos, and other aviation-related content. This is your show, so search for The Next Trip on Twitter and let Doug and Drew know what you want to talk about. Not on Twitter? You can also email them at nexttrip.podcast@gmail.com. Please consider leaving a review wherever you download your podcasts. It will help other listeners like you discover this show.
Well, my dad mentioned the priesthood. That lasted like, I was like, yeah, no.